poor little Jim and Tammy's desire to build a Christian playground in the Carolinas. And we give tax exemption to the contributions to further this gain, this goal. And then, rich as they are, as we saw last night, we then take from the other people tax dollars to pay expenses for his current missionary tour of the United States to help bring us into the fold. Hey, I ain't against it. I'm just pointing it out. Give them their shot. But give the rest of us our shot with equally free rein. Whenever the Pope calls upon Catholics to defend the Catholic Church, either directly or indirectly, they must obey. Because, quote, belief in the Church will not be kept pure and genuine if it is not supported by belief in the primacy of the Bishop of Rome. Since Christ built his one and only church on Peter the Rock, Catholics must obey the Pope in matters of faith and morals to be sure, and since morals are inseparable from ethics, and ethics are inseparable from social problems, and social problems inseparable from political, and political problems inseparable from economic ones, it follows that Catholics cannot in the long run avoid being directed by the Pope via his hierarchy in all of those domains, social, political, and economic. Furthermore, their obedience, the Pope enjoins, should be perfect because it cannot be given in shreds. These are statements in encyclicals after infallibility is claimed. Why should not such obedience be given in shreds? That is, partly. Why should not Catholics be permitted if they wish to refuse obedience? Because, the Pope explains, quote, union of minds requires not only a perfect accord in the one faith, but complete submission and obedience of will to the Church and to the Roman Pontiff as to God Himself. Sapientiae Christiani. That's the encyclical that declares that. And in case Catholics of the future should be so ignorant or so naive or so cunning as to think that present or future popes might stultify the injunctions of their predecessors concerning the unchangeability of this most fundamental of papal commands, the Pope clarified the matter in no uncertain terms with an infallible declaration. Whatever the popes have hitherto taught or shall hereafter teach, he declared, quote, must be held with a firm grasp of the mind, and so often as occasion requires, must be openly professed. To prove that the popes of the recent past were right, the Pope of the present confirmed their sayings. Quote, here everything speaks of authority, said Pope Paul VI, referring to the Vatican and to himself. Quote, the keys of Peter figure everywhere. Keys of Peter figure everywhere. Over here. The keys of Peter figure everywhere. In subtle display, though he stands in a foreign country, head and shoulders above everyone else outside the great cathedral in Mexico City, hanging in front of him the crest, or rather the coat of arms, that not so subtly announces to Mexico, here stands the man who holds the keys to the kingdom. The keys of Peter figure everywhere. The presence of the Pope, the visible head of the Church, I'm quoting, reminds everyone that there exists in the Church a supreme power which is a personal prerogative, having authority over the entire community united in the name of Christ, a power that is not only purely external, but is capable of creating or annulling internal obligations of conscience, and not indeed something left to the optional choice of the faithful, but necessary to the structure of the church, and not derived from the latter, but from Christ and from God. Notice the papal reminder. You, the faithful, don't have an optional choice. The presence of the Pope is the visible authority. He speaks for God. Because of their inherent allegiance and obedience to the Pope, therefore, Catholics, once they voluntarily accept that, are no longer free citizens. The fact that they cannot make personal decisions when dealing with certain fundamental matters means that they're not even free agents and even less free individuals. It cannot be otherwise. Catholics have a dual allegiance, one to their church, one to the state, in that order. When church and state are in harmony, well and good. When they're not, then the Catholic is conscience-bound to bring the state to heel. Catholics, therefore, by the mere fact of being Catholics, are instruments for the promotion of a ceaseless warfare against a non-Catholic society. An armistice can be agreed upon only when such society submits to Catholic dicta or has been rendered Catholic. Thanks to this, the average Catholic is the soldier of an army fighting a relentless campaign of subjugation and conquest against anything and anyone not conforming to it, and this is so because, owing to the blind obedience which he owes his church, the Catholic is ceaselessly used by her as a willing instrument wherever needed for undermining, weakening, opposing, boycotting, pressuring, and even fighting anyone and anything, including the society of which he's otherwise a loyal member. The intangible and concrete strictures of a never-ending campaign of expansion, whether promoted in some obscure hamlet in the wilderness or amid the skyscraper turbulence of a modern metropolis, whether waged against the humble or conducted against the mighty for the benefit of Catholic nations or for the discomfort of non-Catholic ones, it's there for all to see, to marvel at, and to fear. For truly, while her opponents are feverishly identifying themselves with the glorification of trivia and the magnification of the inane, stupefied by their own splendiferous self-abasement, the Catholic Church is arraying her forces to go forth not only as a church militant, but as a conquering army on the march. Crockett, Texas. Is the book you're reading from available in the bookstore? No. And if so, what price is it? It's not available. Sorry. In fact, it's been removed from library shelves all around the world, mutilated and destroyed. This is a university network that pursues truth at all costs, asking for 7,000 that haven't bowed their knee to stand up and be counted and declare your support. Now, I've been quarreling, as they say in Missouri, been quarreling. Quarreling with the way in which the news media is insensitive to the rights of other faiths to pursue with equal vim and vigor their religious agenda as the Catholics. We have a stark contrast between the way in which the media unceasingly attack religion at large, its methods, demanded conformity to its standards, disclosure of its innards as the price of approval of the world after the Jim Baker fiasco, and right in stark contrast, here comes the Catholic Church with the entire media fawning on the Pope's visit here. Many more dollars for which there cannot be found a practical use. Tax dollars being spent to make it possible for adulation to be heaped upon the Pope by the faithful. I'm not against that. I just think what's fair is fair. And why should the followers of PTL be belittled and made to look like mutton heads while, like dogs worrying a bone, the media revels in exposing weaknesses, most of them unsupported, and allegations and charges against Jim and Tammy Baker in order to make all Protestants who supported them look like a fool. Well, but there are things wrong, which leads me to, nobody knew it till the news media harped on it, which leads me to, in God's name, an investigation into the murder of John Paul, Pope John Paul I. A few things in the Catholic closet. That the faithful who will line the parade routes of the Pope know very little about. At least I got one other station in Los Angeles talking about the Vatican Bank, Channel 4 tonight. Last night we ended with Cardinal Spellman of New York saying, next to Jesus Christ, the greatest thing that happened to the Catholic Church is Bernardino Nogara. He had taken what in modern dollars is worth $500 million given by the Italian government to the Vatican as a result of the Lateran Treaty, invested it, speculated it, transformed it into an astonishing sum, starting with $80 million, less the thirty million that Pius XI and his successor Pius XII held back to spend on regional seminaries and parish houses in southern Italy, the building of San Trastevere, and the massive building projects in Rome, including the setting up of the Vatican Library and Art Gallery that was taken out of the sum given by Italy in the Lateran Treaty. $50 million was less, 1929, equivalent $500 million today. Nogara had created Vatican Incorporated. Between 1929 and 1939, he also had access to the annual worldwide collection of Peter's pence. No one has ever given a dime to a Protestant preacher any poorer and less capable of giving it than the thousands who give Peter's pence to the Catholic Church and have down through the centuries. With the pennies of the faithful plus the lire from Mussolini and the Deutschmarks from Hitler, Nogara was able to pass on to his successors a complex array of financial interests worth, at a very conservative estimate, $500 million controlled by the special administration, $650 million controlled by the ordinary section of AFSA, and assets in the Vatican Bank in excess of $940 million, with an annual profit from the bank averaging $40 million going directly to the Pope. Now, I hear rumblings that the government is saying that the so-called $1 million paid to Jim Baker, and I think 10 cents paid to him is too much for what he did, but I didn't give anything to him for that reason. Those who gave to him thought he was worth it. As people change sides now to stay on the side of those that sign the check, giving various moral reasons for doing it, they all knew what was going on. And they cashed their checks from the same source, bought their ice cream cones. All this hypocrisy makes me sick. And tax exemption is going to be denied PTL because too much money went to the leader. Well, now, what's good for the goose, good for the gander? Why don't we take away tax exemption for the Catholic Church in America because $40 million goes to the Pope from just the bank alone? One of the reasons they want to take away tax exemption for PTL and the right of the people that have supported it to give with freedom is that they had a party for the staff. Spent, I think, $8,000 or $10,000. I'll make you a bet that the one lunch for the bishops that the Pope has here in Los Angeles will cost more than that. And we had a caller last night say the caterer indicated the lunch for the Pope alone would cost $229. No, I'm sure he's going to eat the same lunch as the rest of them, so multiply that by 300 bishops. If PTL should lose its exemption for that, why not the Catholic Church? What's fair is fair, folks. I can get away with saying this because I will not allow anybody in my church now to give and take tax deduction for anything. You do it, you're on your own. I won't defend you. IRS like me, I'll say we don't believe in it. They say, well, they said they gave to your church. Will you support that? I say, I don't reveal the name of anybody who gives to our church. If they want to do it, it's on their conscience. No comment. I intend to stay ahead of what Antichrist is doing. $40 million going directly to the Pope. No wonder he wears silk pants under the robes. You think he buys his silk pants and his robes? With his own little money? They have a nifty thing here in America. You can deduct the price of clerical robes as a uniform that you wear in the pulpit. But you can't deduct them if they're street clothes. Have you ever seen the Pope in a three-piece suit? I mean, I tell you, they're the smartest of all of them. By cracky, they wear the tax-deductible garments in the street. In capitalistic terms, Nagara's service in the cause of the Roman Catholic Church was an incredible success. Viewed in the light of the message contained in the Gospels, it was a change. The Vicar of Christ had acquired a new unofficial title, Chairman of the Board. And the Globe has just reported that the Chairman of the Board, par excellence, old blue eyes, Frank Sinatra, going to give half of his fortune to the Pope. More power to him. He believes in the Pope. He has the right to give it to who he wants to. That's what this country's about. But so do those that want to give it to their Protestant or other church leaders. And they shouldn't feel intimidated about it. And nobody's asking, well, now what's the Pope going to do with the money? He's going to spend it, fool, or save it, or invest it. Maybe put it in the Vatican Bank that never discloses anything. Only allowed one picture to be taken of its interior. 4 years after Nagara's death in 1958, the Vatican had urgent need of the kind of expertise that Nagara had provided. The Italian government had raised the specter of taxing stock dividends again. What followed has a direct bearing on a sequence of disasters for the Vatican, including mafia involvement, financial mayhem, and murder that would begin in 1968. And remember, we picked up the story in the Vatican Connection. Started as a plant in the Playboy Club in New York City, where hoodlums were harassing, and led to the uncovering of a scheme of selling counterfeit and stolen securities to the tune of $900 million, almost $1 billion worth, to the Vatican. And the prime mover on the Vatican side was none other than Paul Marcinkus, head of the Vatican Bank. I'll get back to this story, but let's carry on here, because that one begins in 1970, 2 years earlier. The beginning was in 1968. In any list of years purporting to be the worst in the church's history, 1968 should feature very near the top. It was also the year when, in halls and corridors, the nicknames were used, quote, the gorilla and the shark, as they were known, were let loose on the two Vatican banks. The gorilla is Paul Marcinkus or Marcinkus. The shark, Michelle or Mikkel or Mikkeli, pronounced various ways, Sindona. And the events that led to their control of Vatican finances make some interesting reading. Benjamin Franklin memorably observed, quote, but in this world nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. Not many would argue with that statement. Among the few who have are the men who control Vatican's finances. They have made strenuous attempts to eliminate taxes. More power to them. Render to Caesar that which is Caesar's and to God that which is God's. I'm all for it. I don't do it, but I'm all for it. And I don't not do it the way Paul refused to take from the Corinthians because of pride. I don't do it because of smarts. I don't want to owe anything to the government. In December 1962, the Italian government passed legislation taxing the profits on dividends. Initially, the tax was set at 15%, then it went the way of all taxes and was doubled. The Vatican at first raised no objection to paying the tax, at least not publicly. Privately, through diplomatic channels, it advised the Italian government, quote, in the spirit of our concordat, or agreement, and considering the law of 1942, it would be desirable that a favorable treatment be granted to the Holy See. End quote. Negotiations have begun. The secret letter from the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Cicognani, I guess, to the Italian ambassador to the Holy See, Bartolomeo Mignoni, goes on to detail exactly what the favorable treatment should be. Tax exemption for a list of departments as long as a cardinal's arm, including, of course, the two Vatican banks, the special administration, and what had come to be known as the IOR. The Vatican wanted to play the market, but not to pay for the privilege. The minority Vatican-backed Christian Democratic government of the day touched its forelock, kissed the papal ring, and agreed to the Vatican's request. Neither Parliament nor public opinion was consulted. When the minority government fell to be replaced by Christian Democrat Aldo Moro with a coalition of Christian Democrats and Socialists, the post of finance minister went to Socialist Roberto Tremoloni. He was disinclined to approve what was clearly an illegal agreement made by his predecessor, made furthermore without being ratified by Parliament, and even more important, made 8 days after the government had resigned. These are the custodians of moral law. Aldo Moro, confronted with a finance minister threatening to resign on the one hand and an intransigent Vatican on the other, sought a compromise. He asked the Vatican to submit a statement of its holdings, disclosure, as a prelude to obtaining exemption. Not unreasonably, the prime minister felt that the Italian nation should know just how much money they were being deprived of. The Vatican refused to reveal the details and talked loudly about being a sovereign state. Apparently, it is perfectly permissible to exploit the stock market of another sovereign state and make profits from the exploitation, but the exploited state's not allowed to know by just how much it's being exploited. Right on. I'm all for it. Give them an A+. All I'm saying is, why beat up on these poor little old churches and television evangelists not Catholic in America for not disclosing their few millions and ignoring this. I mean, if we're going to start complaining about disclosure, start with the biggie. I mean, by the time you read through their disclosure statement, I'd be dead and gone, so I don't have to worry about them getting to the next one. I don't think they should have to disclose. Now, we're not talking about contributions from the faithful. We're talking about the money they make in investments through their two banks. Now, the news media is beating the poor Protestant preachers to death because they don't disclose the contributions of the faithful, which God's Word in Matthew 6 clearly says should be given in secret. Doing not a damn thing to force the Catholic Church, is the price of its tax exemptions in this country, to disclose its multitudinous investments. I'm not complaining that the Catholic Church doesn't disclose. I'm complaining at the cowardly news media acting like a bunch of sneaking wolves trying to find a weak cow and take it on and avoid the pack and the bulls and where they'd have a real test. They're like sneaking coyotes following a herd of cattle, finding one poor, sick, weak one. Why are they attacking PTL? Because a wimp fled. It's cold in here. My attack is on the unfairness of the media. Their gutless worrying of a poor little old wimp. And who's being punished at PTL? Not Falwell. He's fat catting it to some new imagery. Getting his fat face in front of millions and never saw him before. Not Jim and Tammy. They're running around acting like wimps and worrying people for sympathy. The donors to PTL, who are having their privacy and their eternal rewards and their sacred religious rights violated by battalions of government worms crawling around and seizing and then looking. You're supposed to have protection against unlawful search and seizure. You're supposed to search for a specific thing and seize it after you get a warrant. But to retain his hostile takeover position and to make himself look like a spiritual hero and to start the run for disclosure, but all these gutless leaders are more interested in their spiritual imagery and retaining their position than they are protecting the religious sacred rights of the people and the constitutional rights of the people. Give the key to Caesar and let him come in and seize everything, including what violates the rights of the donors to PTL, and then search through it. He asked the Vatican to submit a statement. Vatican refused. Various governments came and went. The issue was discussed from time to time in the Italian parliament. There was no disclosure. At one point in 1964, the Vatican indicated just how far it had gone in abandoning Christ's dictum, "My kingdom is not of this earth," and embracing instead the teachings of Bernardino Nogaro. Quote, "Increase the size of your company because fiscal controls on the part of the government become advantageously difficult." I like Nogaro. Increase the size of your company because the bigger you get, fiscal controls on the part of the government become advantageously difficult. The company to which Nogaro was referring was the Vatican. The government, those unfortunates across the Tiber who were obliged to deal with an offshore tax haven in the middle of Rome. Am I boring you? In June 1964, with Aldo Moro again in power, the Church of the Poor threatened to bring down the entire Italian economy. During negotiations, Vatican officials told the Italian government that if they did not get their way, they would throw onto the market every single share they held in Italy. They picked their moment well. The Italian stock market was going through a particularly bad period with shares dropping daily. Suddenly, to dump on the market the enormous holdings of the Vatican would have destroyed the entire Italian economy. The Italian government, faced with this reality, capitulated. On October 1964, a draft bill was prepared that would ratify the illegal agreement. The draft bill was never put before Parliament, mainly because governments were collapsing more quickly than the various finance ministers could discover what was in their inboxes. Meanwhile, the Vatican continued to enjoy tax exemption. It had not paid tax on its shares since April 1963. In 1967, the Italian press, specifically the left-wing press, went on the attack. They wanted to know why the Vatican hadn't paid taxes on its shares. They also wanted to know how much. They also wanted to know how many shares the Vatican held in their country. Figures began to fly. They ranged from estimates that put the worth of the Vatican investment on the Italian stock exchange at $160 million to others that put it at $2.4 billion. In March 1967, the Italian finance minister, Luigi Preti, in response to questions in the Italian Senate, threw some official light on the Vatican's holdings in Italy. Not voluntarily given, by the way. His breakdown from his analysis showed that by far the biggest Vatican investor was the IOR, the main bank, followed by the special administration, the second part of the two-part bank. Various other Vatican departments with high-sounding names, such as the Fabric of St. Peter's, the Pontifical Society for St. Peter Apostle, the Administration of the Holy See Patrimony, and Propaganda Fidei, were also revealed as players of the stock market. Finance Minister Preti stated that the Vatican owned shares worth approximately $104.4 million in 1967 that he could discover. The actual total figure was undoubtedly much higher. And our tax dollars, by the way, here in Los Angeles, are going to be spent to buy barrels full of water to be tied together with ropes to protect him. I think he'll be protected. I'm all for it. I just want them to get off the back of Protestant Christians. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Preti's figure did not take into account the large Vatican investment in government bonds and debentures that are completely exempt from any form of taxation. He was dealing only with the shares that were taxable. Nor did Preti concern himself with the fact that under Italian stock exchange regulation, the holder of shares is allowed to leave the dividends uncollected for 5 years. You want me to continue?
Yes.
On the phone. I'm reading from In God's Name, an investigation into the murder of Pope John Paul I, and I'm in the background section. In 1968, after turning the assets given to them by the Italian government by the Lateran Treaty in 1929 into multiplied millions, the formation of two Vatican banks, the primary one called IOR, the controversy developed as the Italian government sought to tax dividends on stocks. The Vatican attempted to bring down the economy of Italy by threatening to sell all of their holdings unless their exemptions were granted, and they hadn't paid taxes for several years. The finance minister, Preti, on his own research, where available, because the Catholic Church had refused to disclose its holdings, calculated about $100 million plus in ordinary stocks and another $100 million in tax-exempt bonds and debentures, government bonds and debentures. So eventually, Italy decided to call the Vatican's bluff. The Roman Catholic Church should, at least in Italy, render unto Caesar what was Caesar's, they felt. In January 1968, yet another transitory government led by Giovanni Leone, declared that at the end of the year, the Vatican would have to pay up. With considerable ill grace and comments about its investments being a wonderful stimulus for the Italian economy, the Vatican agreed, but in typical Vatican fashion. It asks for time to pay in easy installments. The whole affair had a number of unfortunate results for the Vatican. I'm reading this because I think, since the news media revels in destroying the faith of those who followed a Protestant TV evangelist that I didn't follow, and seem totally unwilling to use the same airways to raise some questions in the minds of the Catholic Church about some of its skeletons in its closet, I thought I'd do the service. See, I think they both should be left alone. The whole affair had a number of unfortunate results for the Vatican. Whatever the actual total, everybody in Italy was now aware that the Church of the Poor had very large investments producing millions of dollars of annual profit. Further, the six-year-old dispute had resulted in many companies being identified as Vatican-owned or controlled. The wide portfolio might indicate shrewd capitalism, but it was bad public relations to let the man who complained that his phone, water, electricity, and gas were not working know that he had the Church to thank for it. Then, most important of all, if the Vatican maintained its heavy investments in Italy, it was going to face very large tax bills. Pope Paul VI had a problem. The men he turned to for the solution were the guerrilla, Paul Marcinkus, and the shark, Michele Sindona. If Sigmund Freud's conclusion that a person's entire personality is formed the first 5 years of life is correct, then Paul Marcinkus merits particularly close study by the experts. And even those who dispute Freud's conclusion acknowledge that environment's a major influence in the formative years. Marcinkus, the mystery man now who hides out in the Vatican, even though the Supreme Court has said the arrest warrant can't be enforced, was born into a city ruled by the mafia, where gang-style murders were everyday occurrence in his youth, where corruption reached from the mayor to the teenage. It was a city riddled with every conceivable type of crime, in which between 1919 and 1960, 976 gang-style murders were committed and only two of the murderers convicted. It was a city where the autumn of 1928, the president of the crime commission appealed to one man to ensure that the forthcoming November elections were conducted in an honest, democratic manner. The man selected to make sure it was honest was Al Capone. The city, Chicago. Capone boasted, "I own the police." A more accurate statement would have been, "I own the city." Now, his role is being played up right now in the movie The Untouchables. I didn't tell half the story. Capone responded to the plea for fair elections. He told the police of America's second largest city what to do, and the police obeyed. The president of the crime commission later observed it turned out to be the squarest and most successful election day in 40 years, thanks to Al Capone. There was not one complaint. No threat of trouble all day. Paul Marcinkus was born in the suburb of Cicero on January 15, 1922. The following year, Al Capone, confronted with the extraordinary spectacle of an honest mayor and an equally honest chief of police in Chicago, moved his headquarters to Cicero. The population of some 60,000, mainly first and second generation Poles, Bohemians, and Lithuanians, became accustomed to the sight of the mafia in their midst. Capone set up headquarters at the Hawthorne Inn at 4833 22nd Street. Along with Capone came such gentlemen as Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik, Tony Mops Volpe, Frank the Enforcer Nitty, and Frankie the Millionaire Newsboy Pope. This was the Cicero in which Paul Casimir Marcinkus grew up. His parents were Lithuanian immigrants. His father earned a living cleaning windows, and his mother worked in a bakery. Well, we know everything about Tammy Baker and the thickness of her makeup. Why can't I tell you about Marcinkus? He's still hiding out in the Vatican. On Channel 4 News tonight, they showed pictures of him serving as the bodyguard for the current Pope on one of his travels. Before the heat set in, they managed to leave it out of this Quest for Peace book. Let's just study this fellow. His father earned a living cleaning... Am I boring you? I don't really care. I'm interesting myself. His father earned a living cleaning windows, and his mother worked in a bakery. Their grasp of the English language was poor. In the classic manner of many of the poor immigrants who sought a better life in the land of the free, they determined that their children, through honest endeavor and hard work, should have better lives. Marcinkus, the youngest of their five children, succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. His is the story of local boy makes God's banker. Guided by his parish priests, Marcinkus developed a vocation for the priesthood. He was ordained in 1947, the year Al Capone died. Monsignor William Gorman, who officiated at the Catholic burial of America's all-time public enemy number one, explained to reporters, quote, "The church never condones evil, nor the evil in any man's life. This very brief ceremony is to recognize his, Capone's, penitence and the fact that he died fortified by the sacraments of the church." I mean, if you can't whip them, you join them. Back to Catholic power today. Bye. Avro Manhattan. Too hot in here. There's something really interesting here I want you to see. Interesting little big net in here. Now, the Catholic Church, since it does the saving, a story in here about some Catholic prostitute that when her trick laughed at her Catholic cross and things that was heading, hanging on her bedpost after he was already undressed. She threw her money at him, because they always collect in advance. She threw her money at him and told him to go find himself a Protestant prostitute. I already told you now, I don't have to look for it. Marcinkus went to Rome and studied at the same Catholic University Gregorian at which Albino Luciani had obtained his degree. The Pope, who reigned for 33 days and died mysteriously. Marcinkus was equally successful and obtained his doctorate in canon law. During his high school days, he had used his 6'3" of height and his 224 pounds of brawn with considerable success on the football field. His physical strength was to prove a decided asset as he became a bodyguard to popes. Returning to Chicago, he worked as a parish priest and then became a member of the ecclesiastical court of the diocese. One of the first to be impressed with Marcinkus was the then head of the Archdiocese of Chicago, Cardinal Samuel Stritch. After a recommendation from the Cardinal, Marcinkus was transferred to the English section of the Vatican Secretary of State's office in 1952. Tours of duty attached to the papal nuncios of Bolivia and Canada followed. Then in 1959, he returned to Rome in the Secretary of State's department. His fluency in Spanish and Italian ensured his constant employment as an interpreter. In 1963, the Cardinal of New York, Francis Spellman, during one of his frequent trips to Rome, advised Pope Paul that Marcinkus was a priest with an excellent potential. In view of the fact that Spellman headed one of the wealthiest dioceses in the world at that time and was frequently referred to as Cardinal Moneybags, a tribute to his financial genius, the Pope began quietly to monitor Paul Marcinkus, which leads me to what I just hinted at as something we will get into later, the American Pope, the life and times of Francis Cardinal Spellman. From his first days at the North American College in Rome, Spellman carefully cultivated the Vatican inner circle. When New York's Archbishop Hayes died, Spellman quickly made it clear to Rome that he wanted to run the largest, wealthiest, most powerful archdiocese in America. And he did. He's the one that said, best thing happened to the church since Jesus Christ. It was Bernardino Nogara who built the investment bank called the Vatican Bank. The Pope now, on Spellman's recognition of him, began to monitor Paul Marcinkus. In 1964, during a visit to downtown Rome, the Pope was in danger of being trampled by the over-enthusiastic crowd. Suddenly, Marcinkus appeared, using shoulders, elbows, and hands. He physically cleared a path through the crowds for the frightened Pope Paul. The following day, the Pope summoned him for personal thanks, and from then on he became the unofficial bodyguard to the Pope, and his nickname, the Gorilla, was born. In December 1960... Am I boring you?
No, sir.
It's getting late. Can we quit?
No, sir.
In 1964, December, he accompanied Pope Paul to India. They left him out of this book with its pictures. The following year, he went with him to the United Nations. They left him out of this current book, pictures. By now, Marcinkus had taken over the duties of security advisor on such trips. Personal bodyguard, personal security advisor, personal translator, the boy from Cicero had come for. He was by now a close friend of the Pope's personal secretary, Father Pasquale Macchi. Macchi was a key member of the papal entourage, which the Roman Curia referred to as the Milan Mafia. When the Archbishop of Milan, Montino, was elected Pope in 1963, he had brought with him a whole train of advisors, financiers, and clerics. Macchi was one of the entourage. All roads may lead to Rome, a number go via Milan. The dependence that the Pope placed on men like Macchi was out of proportion to their official positions. Macchi would berate the Pope when he considered him morbid or depressed. He'd tell him when to go to bed, who should be promoted, who should be punished for an uncomfortable transfer. After having bid His Holiness good night, Macchi could invariably be found in an excellent restaurant just off the piazza, Gregorio Settimo. His usual companion for dinner was Marcinkus. Backroom politics, bedroom authority. Further trips abroad with the Pilgrim Pope to Portugal in May 67, to Turkey in July of the same year, cemented Marcinkus' friendship with Pope Paul. Later that year, Pope Paul created a department called the Prefecture of the Economic Affairs of the Holy See. A more comprehensible title would have been the General Accounting Office. What the Pope sought was a department that would be able to produce an annual summary of the exact state of Vatican wealth and the progress of all assets and liabilities of every administration of the Holy See, with a view to obtaining figures in black and white that would give a final balance or estimate each year. From its creation, the department had struggled under two very serious handicaps. First, on Pope Paul's express instructions, the Vatican Bank was specifically excluded from the economic exercise. Second, there was Vatican paranoia. Now my sound has gone bad. After the department had been established by a trio of cardinals, the man subsequently appointed to run it was Cardinal Egidio Vagnosi. In theory, he should have been able, after a maximum of 1 year in the job, to inform the Pope of the exact state of Vatican finances. In practice, Bagnozzi found that the inordinate desire for financial secrecy that the various Vatican departments frequently demonstrate to inquiring journalists was extended to him. The congregation of the clergy wanted to keep its figures to itself. So did the APSA. So did all the departments. In 1969, Cardinal Bagnozzi observed to a colleague, "It would take a combination of the KGB, the CIA, and Interpol to obtain just an inkling of how much and where the monies are." That's the guy the Pope appointed to find out. And they are making disclosure the price of existence for Protestant churches in America? It ain't fair. To assist the 84-year-old Cardinal Alberto Di Giorgio, who had been appointed by Bernardino Nogaro, who was still functioning as head of the Vatican Bank, Pope Paul consecrated as Bishop Paul Marcinkus. The morning after Marcinkus had prostrated himself at the feet of the Pope, he took over as the Vatican Bank secretary. For all practical purposes, he was now running the bank, interpreting for President Johnson. When he talked to the Pope, it had been relatively easy, but as Marcinkus freely admitted, "I have no banking experience." From being an obscure priest in Cicero, Paul Marcinkus had risen higher and further in terms of real power in the church than any American before him. One of the men who had assisted the rise of Paul Marcinkus was Giovanni Benelli. His initial assessment to Pope Paul of the golf-playing, cigar-chewing extrovert from Cicero was that Marcinkus would be a valuable asset to the Vatican Bank. Within 2 years, Benelli concluded that he had made a disastrous misjudgment. And you remember he told Pope John Paul I that before Luciani became Pope. Within 2 years, he concluded a disastrous mistake had been made and that Marcinkus should be removed immediately. He soon discovered, however, that in the brief period, Marcinkus had built himself a power base stronger than his own. When the final showdown came in 1977, it was Benelli who left the Vatican. The extraordinary promotion of Marcinkus was part of a carefully planned change of Vatican policy. Paying large amounts of tax on share profits and having a high profile as an owner of countless Italian companies was now decidedly passé for Vatican Incorporated, particularly when those companies made embarrassing little items such as the contraceptive pill, on which Pope Paul had just invoked the wrath of God. The Pope and his advisors had decided to reduce their commitments in the Italian money markets and transfer the bulk of Vatican wealth to the foreign markets, particularly the United States. They also wished to move into the highly lucrative world of euro-dollar blue chips and offshore profits. Marcinkus was selected as an essential component in this strategy. Another essential component was drawn from the Pope's Milan Mafia. This man was in reality not from Milan, but was merely, which was merely his adopted city, but he actually was Mafia. The shark had been born in Pati near Messina, Sicily. His name, Michele Sindona. Or Michele Sindona. Like Albino Luciani, Michele Sindona knew poverty as a child. And like Luciani, he was deeply affected and influenced by that environment. Born in May 8, 1920, educated by the Jesuits, Sindona demonstrated early in life a marked proclivity for mathematics and economics. Having graduated from Messina University with an excellent law degree in 1942, he avoided conscription in Mussolini's armed forces with the aid of a distant relation of his fiancée who worked in the Vatican Secretariat of State, one Monsignor Amleto Tondini. During the last 3 years of the Second World War, Sindona put his law degree to one side and earned a very lucrative living doing what he would ultimately become world famous for, buying and selling. He bought food on the black market in Palermo, smuggled it with the aid of the Mafia to Messina, where it was sold to the starving population. After June 1943 and the Allied landing, Sindona turned to the American forces for his supplies. As business expanded, so did his Mafia connections. 1946, he left Sicily for Milan, taking with him his young wife, Rena, invaluable lessons in the law of supply and demand, a number of even more invaluable letters of introduction from the Archbishop of Messina, whose friendships Sindona had carefully cultivated. In Milan, he lived in the suburbs of Forte, worked for a business consultancy and accounting firm. Sindona's specialty as American capital began to flow into Italy was to show would-be investors how to dance their way through Italy's complex tax laws. His mafia associates were suitably impressed with his progress. He was talented, ambitious, and more important in the eyes of the mafia. He was also ruthless, totally corruptible, and one of their own. He knew the importance of mafia traditions such as omerta, the rule of silence. He was Sicilian. The mafia family Gambino were particularly taken with the young Sindona and his dexterity at placing dollar investments without bothering with tiresome tax regulations. The Gambino family has global interests, but its two main power centers are New York and Palermo. The former, New York, is controlled by the Gambinos, the latter by their Sicilian cousins, the Inzerillos. On November 2nd, 1957, there was a family reunion in the Grand Hotel des Palmas. Palermo, also invited to enjoy the wine and food, was Michele Sindona. The Gambino family made Sindona an offer he accepted with enthusiasm. They wanted him. He don't care. You want me to keep going? Huh. Real interesting. Real, real interesting. Even pictures. I'll be a son of a gun. Huh. Well, again, look at the Swiss Guards salute Paul Marcinkus at the Vatican. You ever been to the Vatican? Seen the Swiss Guards? Look at them saluting here. There's Paul Marcinkus. Strides. Oh, you're on the wrong page. See him saluting him? Interesting pictures. Like Marcinkus, all these men stood to gain by the death of Luciani, Pope John Paul I, Cardinal Jean Bellot. Doesn't he look like somebody that you'd love? And Sindoni over here. You want me to continue? Yeah. Get on phone. Now I'm going to move fast as I finish this portion of what I'm doing. Like Marcinkus, over here, all of these men stood to gain by the death of Luciani, John Paul the First, Cardinal Jean Bellot, Robert Roberto Calvi, Cardinal John Cody in Chicago, Umberto Ortolani, and Michele Sindona. Now, we were reading a little bit about Sindona. Born 1920, educated with the Jesuits, black market trader during the war, invited to a family reunion of the Gambino family at the Grand Hotel des Palmas, Palermo, Sicily. The Gambino family wanted Sindona to manage the family investment of huge profits just beginning to accrue from the sales of heroin. They needed a laundryman. And Sindona, with his proven ability of moving money amounts in and out of Italy without disturbing the tranquility of the government's taxation departments, was an ideal choice. Within 17 months of the Mafia Summit Conference, Sindona bought his first bank, aided by Mafia funding. Sindona had already discovered one of the cardinal rules of theft. The best way to steal from a bank is to buy one. Sindona created a Liechtenstein holding company, Fasco AG. Shortly afterward, Fasco acquired a bank in Milan, the Banco Privata Finanziaria, usually called BPF. Now, you remember when the Federal people arrived in the United States, the FBI and crime commissioners, and began to interview Marcinkus. He has kind things to say about Sindona, his very good friend. Remember that? Well, let's watch his very good friend on the rise. Skipping over all these other things that he did, let's come to one that you probably remember from the news. Let's skip over Jelly and some of the other characters. Wind this down as we look at some of the skeletons in the Catholic closet. Let's skip over Klaus Barbie, unrepentant member of the SS, and some other business partners, and P2, the secret Freemason lodge that infiltrated the Vatican. Michele Sindona was the man chosen now by Pope Paul VI to act as financial advisor to the Vatican. The man chosen after a long friendship with the Pope to relieve the Church of its high-profile business position in Italy. The plan was to sell Sindona some of the major assets acquired under Nogara. Franklin National Bank was the 20th largest bank in the United States. Sindona, the shark, having turned his attention to the United States, there this man who already owned more banks than many men do shirts, bought another bank, the Franklin National Bank in New York. Sindona paid $40 million for 1 million shares in it, representing 21.6% interest. He paid $40 a share at the time when the share price was $32. More important this time, he had bought a very sick bank. Unbeknownst to Sindona, Franklin National was tottering on the very edge of bankruptcy. The true megalomania of Sindona can be gauged from the fact that when he realized what he had acquired, he didn't give a damn. To him, dealing with tottering banks was an everyday event as long as huge deposits could be kept whirling around on paper. As long as the telex machine was there to transfer A to B and then to C and then back to A again. Within 24 hours of his purchase, and before he had even had an opportunity to try out the boardroom for size, Franklin National announced his trading figures for the second quarter of 1972. We're getting close to the Vatican connection now. These showed a 28% drop from the same period for 71. Sindona, the shark, took it in typical Sindona fashion. I have important connections in all important financial centers. Those who do business with Michele Sindona will do business with Franklin National. Previous owners were laughing on the way to another bank. As to the important connections, no one could deny the truth of that. These connections range from the mafia families Gambino and Inzerillo in New York and Sicily to Pope Paul VI, Cardinals Guerri and Caprio, and Bishop Marcinkus in the Vatican. They included Andreotti and Fanfani in Rome and President Nixon and Treasury Secretary David Kennedy in Washington. I knew old Tricky Dick could get in there somewhere. They included intimate banking relationships with some of the most powerful institutions in the world. The Vatican Bank, Ambrose of London, Continental Illinois, and Rothschilds of Paris. Through Jelly's P2, the secret Freemason lodge, he had forged close links with the men who ruled in Argentina, Paraguay, Uruguay, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. Of the Nicaraguan dictator Somoza, he told a Rome lawyer, "I prefer to deal with men like Somoza." Doing business with a one-man dictatorship is much easier than doing business with democratically elected governments. They have too many committees, too many controls. They also aspire to honesty. That's bad for the banking business. By mid-1973, the hole in Sindona's banks had reached enormous proportions. I skip along. Appropriately, the shark sat at his desk practicing the Japanese art of origami. The executive suite in his office on Avenue of the Americas in New York was littered with countless examples of his paper-folding expertise. Just like so many companies, empty little boxes piled on top of one another. The shark was now involved in a wild intercontinental juggling act. The merging of this company with that finance house, the transfer of those shares for that company, merge, divide, remerge. Il crack Sindona, the Italians called it. When it came, the collapse of the monument to greed and corruption that Sindona had erected was not unimpressive. He had talked grandly of not knowing what his personal wealth was, but he claimed it was in the neighborhood of $500 million. Sindona was a bit confused. The reality was somewhat different. Here's a meteoric pattern of his career. September 1973. At the Waldorf Astoria in New York, the Prime Minister of Italy, Andreotti, rises to his feet at the luncheon and delivers a speech in praise of the shark, hails him as the savior of the lire. January 1974, at the Grand Hotel in Rome, U.S. Ambassador John Volpe names the shark Man of the Year for 1973. All after his meeting with the Gambino family in Sicily. March 1974, prices on the Milan Stock Exchange are flying high as is the exchange rate against the dollar at 825 lire. If Sindona were to close down the huge currency operations, now he would emerge with a profit of at least 100 billion lire. Anna Bonomi, a rival in the Milan financial world, makes an excellent offer for Sindoni's holdings in the Mobiliari. Sindoni refuses to sell. April 74, the stock market goes into decline and the exchange rate falls dramatically. This is the beginning of Il crack Sindona. The Franklin National Bank in New York announces a net operating income for the first quarter of 2 cents a share, compared with the previous year's 68 cents. Even this is falsified. The reality is the bank had suffered a $40 million loss. May 74, Franklin has the brakes put on its massive currency speculation. National Westminster of London objects to the volume of Franklin's sterling clearings through its account. July 74, the holes are showing both in Italy and in the United States. In an attempt to fill the Italian hole, the shark merges Banca Unione and Banca Privata Finanziaria. He calls the new creation Banca Privata. Instead of two medium-sized sick banks, he now has one very large sick bank. Instead of two large holes, one gigantic hole is revealed, a 200 billion lire hole. August 74, time for the establishment to rally around. In Italy, Banca di Roma, having taken a large part of the Sindona Empire as collateral, sinks $128 million into Banca Privata in an attempt to fill the hole. In the United States, the government, fearing the collapse of Franklin National could have serious repercussions, gives Franklin National unlimited access to federal funds. Over $2 billion flows from the Federal Reserve into Franklin. They're the ones who want to keep us churches honest. September 74, Banca Privata goes into compulsory liquidation. Estimated losses, over $300 million. This includes $27 million of Vatican money plus their shares of the bank. October 3rd, 74, Licio Gelli repays a little of the huge investment that Sindona had made in P2. By courtesy of P2 members and the judiciary and the police force, Gelli is advised that Sindona will be arrested the following day. Gelli tips off Sindona. October 4th, an arrest warrant for Michele Sindona is issued. Sindona has fled the country. Ever a man of vision, he's previously changed his nationality. He's now a citizen of Switzerland. The boy from Sicily flies to his homeland in Geneva. October 8th, Franklin National collapses. Losses to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in America, $2 billion. It's the biggest bank failure in American history. October 74 to January 75, Europe resounds to the noise of crashing banks that are Sindona-controlled or linked. Bankhaus, Wolf AG of Hamburg, Bankhaus IK Herstadt of Cologne, Amincore Bank of Zurich, and Finabank of Geneva. With regard to Finabank, Swiss banking sources estimate Vatican losses at $240 million. The Finabank losses on foreign exchange dealings alone are a minimum of $82 million. And now they buy $900 million worth of stolen currency from the Mafia. Which leads me to the Vatican connection. Why hasn't the news media done something with this? Well, they beat poor little old Jim Baker to death and applaud the Pope in his Pope Mobile and the spending of tax dollars. They say, you're against the Pope? No, I'm not against it. I just think what's fair is fair. Even tired as you are, you ought to be able to see that. I mean, I've done a pretty quick run over of an awful lot of stuff, the gestalt of which is the Catholic Church has been a little less than pure. And they have not even cleansed the air by coming out and disclosing. And Pickle of Texas has not invited the Pope to his investigation into church funds planned for the fall, that Jimmy Swaggart is going to lead the parade and become the first miracle of a kind like Balaam's ass in this century. And I believe that the Pope ought to come to Los Angeles. I believe he's a good Pope. He may have lost money in the Vatican Bank. Maybe we ought to feel sorry for him. He could have two pairs of silk trousers under his robes. I just think what's fair is fair. Are you starting to feel a little less defensive about giving to a ministry that teaches you faithfully? And by cracky, until the Pope discloses, I ain't even going to think about it. And after he discloses, I'll think about it. And after I think about it for a while, I'll say, no. But I don't even have to say that until the Pope discloses. They want me to disclose, I'm going to say, hey, he got more than I got. Occupy yourself with him first. And that's the point I'm making. I think I've made it. The gestalt is obvious. These are men selected by the Pope to run Vatican finances that they refuse to disclose, fed by Peter's pence. Now, it's time that the world wake up to the fact that the Protestants don't need to be on the defensive. And I'm tired of this gang warfare of the news media against a few Protestants that dare to believe that they have something to say just because of bad eggs in the basket or a bad apple in the barrel. Doesn't give the news media the right to intrude in on time-honored rights, inalienable rights to worship as we see fit. And their concern over the poor given to the wrong person and how the money is used falls rather hollow when you see them salivating over the Pope with a history like this. Now that point's obvious, and ought to have some of you mad enough to stand up and be counted.